This is a podcast from Minute Media.
Hello, and welcome to the Over and Back Classic NBA Podcast. I am Jason, and with me, as usual, is Rich. Hello, Rich.
Hey, what's going on?
Not too much. And we also have joining us our very special guest, Dr. Curtis Harris of Pro Hoops History. Welcome, Curtis.
Thanks, Jason, and I'm glad you remembered the doctor this time. It was very...
I got to give the doctor's respect after all.
I mean, you did earn it. So, yeah. I'm not a doctor. I'm not going to be anytime soon, I don't think. So, yeah, you earned it. No, you pulled it along.
We recognize two doctors here. We recognize Dr. J. We recognize Dr. Curtis Harris. We do not recognize any other docs, however, not even Doc Rivers.
So, not Dr. Rivers.
Yeah. We just call him Glenn. Proviso East's finest alum. Wow. Unbelievable.
Indeed. Well, we are here, unfortunately, for sad reasons. Bill Russell, the greatest winner in basketball, probably in pro sports history, certainly on a team level, passed away at age 88. Day that we, I think we've even talked about maybe on the air about, like, how are we going to handle when Bill Russell finally passes on, and here we are. We've got a collection of memories, going to talk about some of his greatest accomplishments, some of his greatest, most critical games, but we're just going to keep it loose here and talk about what Bill Russell meant to us. So Curtis, what if you were going to try to have any kind of summing up of what Bill Russell meant to the NBA, meant to the world at large, what would you say?
Well, starting off with the small questions, aren't we?
That's why I just kind of set the stage. Tell us about the one of the most important figures in sports and human history.
Yeah.
Well, pretty safe argument for him being the most important player in NBA history. Leave aside arguments about who's the best player. Like, I'm talking most important player in NBA history. And then, just the fact that, I got nothing to do right now. It's summer break. So, just checking the news and, CNN and NBC devoted a good chunk of time to Bill Russell, like not just his basketball, but his civil rights work. So, I think there's very few athletes who, when they pass on, are going to have like a portion on a network like CNN where they're going to talk about, oh yeah, he was a great athlete, fantastic, but also give like equal time to what they did off the court in such a fashion. So it's Bill Russell, Muhammad Ali recently obviously had a similar, type of honoring when he passed away. Really going forward, the only person on the horizon that's going to get that kind of similar treatment, I think, is Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. So clearly a hugely important player, but also just person in U.S. history, I think.
Yeah, it was today I was listening to NBA radio most of the day on Sirius XM, and they had a number of people just coming on and talking. And Curtis, exactly what you said, everybody, initially – had to qualify. Yeah, we'll talk about the basketball in a second. This was old players. This was, Bob Ryan that went on there. These were, and every single person started the interview exactly the same way. They would say, yeah, one of the greatest winners, but the other stuff, let's talk about the other stuff. And like you said, it's really cool to see it be that way, that it's not, it's so easy to just look at 11 titles and we'll talk about, 21-0 in elimination games and that sort of stuff. And there's a lot of places where you're going to get that and people are going to talk about the all-time winner and all that sort of stuff. But this is today, it's an unfortunate day. It's an unfortunate news and all this stuff, but it is an important day because then it does allow everybody to have those same conversations again and go back to, hey, this is what this guy went through. And this is in our lifetimes. This is not, 1850. This isn't, 200 years ago. This is a man who all of us saw in the living, in the flesh. And this is what he endured not that long ago, pretty recently. This is what he endured. And I think that is one of the most important parts about a day like this and why, like you said, it shows that he's not just an athlete, that it isn't just, hey, this guy was really, really good and he accomplished a lot. It's about more than that. And every single person that I heard talk about him did not want to start out with talking about the winning, did not want to start and talk about, oh, he's a great defensive player and this is what he did offensively. And yeah, he didn't score, but he did. It was all about, well, here's, what he did and here's what he meant to me and here's what he meant to you know, just people that you know, just the NBA at large, humans at large, and particularly, you know, minorities at large, and that's just an incredible legacy that he led, and I agree, it is awesome that is front and center in every single thing, is less so the play on the court, which is we'll get to, of course, and you have to, because that's what makes him that much more legendary. But I think what truly cements him as a legend in sports and in, you know, just human history, basically, is what he did outside of the game. Until the day, you know, the final few years of his life, he was still very, very active and very vocal and did so much to help so many people and still, at, you know, in some ways, you know, still fighting against a lot of the same stuff that he was fighting against 50, 60 years ago, which sucks.
Yeah. No, and just furthermore, to add on to that, even when people would speak about him in terms of playing basketball, it wasn't even so much how he played basketball. It was just his interaction with teammates. And people would just talk about, like, yeah, like just his attitude toward winning is what was, like, really important for us. There weren't a whole lot of focus. There wasn't a lot of focus on particular games, maybe because people don't remember the games like it was, you know, 60 years ago. But just very few people left now who have played with him. But people who, like, I guess the next generation afterwards, like I saw an interview with Kareem, and then obviously much later on, people like Doc Rivers, and I was watching ESPN, and like Kendrick Perkins was talking about it, and I was like, yeah, like this is how influential Bill Russell was. Like even Kendrick Perkins was sounding coherent. I'm sorry about that.
No, I don't disagree, Curtis.
Kendrick Perkins was like, you know, he was talking about how, you know, just how Bill Russell affected him as a person, and so like even when they were talking about basketball, it wasn't even strictly about his blocking, his rebounding, his defense. It was just how he influenced people and their personalities and in their demeanor and how they approach basketball. So even then, it was still like transcending the simplicity of like, the rebounds and the blocks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that, you know, even the like Bill Russell, you know, there's people out there, you know, who are dumb, who make plumber jokes or whatever, but like Bill Russell, like never got that. Like people just respected Bill Russell so much for who he was, what he stood for. Just his presence was just, you know, really, you know, almost regal in a way. He just commanded respect because of who he was and what he did. Even other people who, you know, might disrespect the game of his era aren't just going to disrespect him because of just, you know, what a tremendous player and tremendous, you know, athlete he was. And, you know, and I don't like to throw the word hero around lightly. That's not usually a word I use, and certainly not really a word I would use mostly for athletes, you know, because obviously we're just talking about a game here. But in terms of like what he stood for in his life, what he faced, you know, what he accomplished both as an athlete and as a person, I think hero, you know, definitely, you know, fits some of what he was able to do in his life.
Yeah. And one thing that I always remembered about Bill Russell, you know, especially growing up and not, you know, obviously watching his games in real time as I was growing up or whatever, is just that when he appeared on television, when he appeared at a game, when he was at an All-Star game, when he was at an NBA Finals, you know, handing somebody the MVP trophy or whatever, the one that eventually, you know, had his name on it, like there was just that he had this presence about him, this immense respect that Bill Russell couldn't walk in the room and players could just continue tying their shoes. You know what I mean? They had to stop and stand up and, hey, how are you? Like, he commanded that presence, and he wasn't the biggest guy. You know what I mean? He's a very big guy, obviously, but there's something about his presence that bigger guys will walk in the room. Bigger guys have played in the NBA. Bigger guys have done, but they don't command that presence that Bill Russell did. And that kind of applied to the way he played on the court as well, because, you know, you watch games and you're like, yeah, I mean, he's big and he's athletic, but like there's bigger guys and there's more athletic guys, but they're not Bill Russell. They don't command the respect that Bill Russell does. They don't command the gravity that a Bill Russell does. And you saw that when you go back and watch old games, and you saw that even in his post-playing career, that when he walked into the room, everything stopped. And it was all about, holy crap, here's Bill Russell. And everybody had to pay their, whether it's the respects, their whatever, or just to pick his brain for even a second if you could, because you knew you were going to get something out of every single conversation you had with the guy.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, if you just want to look at, you know, his basic key NBA accomplishments, we've obviously shared these before, but just to kind of break it down, just of you know, how immense accomplishments that he had. You know, 11 championships, 12 finals in 13 years, including 8 titles in a row. you know, Hall of Famer as a player and a coach. He was the first black coach in the NBA. 5 times MVP, 11 times All-NBA, 3 times on the first list. Obviously, he played with Chamberlain during that time. A lot of times he was on the first team list. Second all-time in rebounds per game, first all-time in playoff rebounds per game. He actually had the most rebounds per minute all-time, 0.53, which is only player in NBA history to average 0.5 or higher. So it wasn't just era. You know, there was other things going on too. Obviously, there was a lot of misses during that time. But he was, you know, he would have been a great rebounder in any era, of course. Only one of 4 players on the NBA's 25th, 35th, 50th, and 75th anniversary teams. You know, who knows how many blocks he would have had if they were charting it, obviously, a ton, but, you know, was known. I mean, basically invented so many concepts of modern defense, you know, blocking shots effectively, you know, leading to, you know, great offense for his team. Just all over the court in terms of how he played defensively, able to, you know, guard big and small players, you know, switching, help defense. I mean, the Celtics basically made a living of just, you know, what they called, hey, Russ defensive. Basically, they would call out Russ's name and he would cover, you know, the territory they needed to, and was able to, you know, they led the league in defense basically every year that he was on the team, you know, most of that time by a mile. Yeah. And, you know, post playing, he was also, you know, he later on, you know, he was able to accomplish a lot as an NBA coach. You know, as we said, he was a Hall of Famer, both as a player and as coach, recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2011, a Lifetime Achievement Award won in the NBA in 2017, NBA Finals MVP named after him starting in 2009, first black player inducted into the Naismith Hall of Fame in 1975. He actually boycotted that because he felt the Hall of Fame was a racist institution.
I would say if he's the first guy inducted in 1975, he's probably right on the money there.
Jesus that Christ. Was strong case for that. Yes.
Good God. I couldn't believe that. Aside. I had to look at that like 7 times to make sure I didn't have that wrong. What?
Now, just a quick aside. They had inducted the New York Renaissance as a team.
Okay.
So that had happened.
So first individual, yeah. I guess. First
sure. Yeah, first individual black player. Yeah, other than the Harlem Wrens, it was just Bill Russell.
But
yeah.
Right. So. Yes. Yes. So thank you.
That doesn't invalidate his point, but I just want to make sure the Rams were not lost.
Right.
Appreciate you that clarification. Yes. 1980 was voted the greatest player in the history of the NBA by the PBWA. And 2013, he was finally given a statue by the city of Boston in City Hall Plaza. Obviously, his relationship with Boston was complicated, I think is a fair word to say. So, yeah, I mean, that's just overwhelming. Again, as a player, you know, one of the greats of all time, certainly on the very short list of greatest players of all time in NBA history, and in terms of, you know, leading the greatest dynasty in NBA history, for sure. So, yeah, I mean, I just think, you know, we've got a lot of stories and anecdotes, you know, listed here that we're going to start talking about. Curtis, is there any favorite, you know, Bill Russell stories, you know, ones that you know or ones that you've heard over the last couple of days as people are sharing their memories?
I guess where I'd get started is just kind of on your list of, I guess, your list of accomplishments and honorifics that Russell got. Of course, the Finals MVP award is named after him, but as we know, he never got one himself. So, you know, last summer, I did my stupid fantasy project of who would have won this award had it actually existed at that moment in time. So the Finals MVP didn't get awarded until 1969. So Jerry West got it that year. And I would say deservedly so. Like, I think at that point he was the best player in that series, even though Russell was in that same finals. But, you know, he was at the very end of his career. But by my estimation, looking at the stats and everything and just like newspaper reports, like, I think it's safe to say Russell got at least 9 Finals MVPs, which I think, like, just starting there, I think, you know, Bill Russell's stories, I think it's just starting with the hypothetical of, like, what if there was a Finals MVP? This man would have had at least 9 of them, by my estimation. And that's me being generous, being like, well, I'll like, he's already got 9 of them. I'll, like, kind of ease up and, like, let's give Bob Cousy one. Just because, like, it's kind of close, let's just give Bob one since he doesn't have one right now. But, like, imagine how much more, you know, titanic Russell's career looks if we have, like, you know, 11-time NBA champion, but also 9-time finals MVP, and then also what, you know, 6, 7, 8-time defensive player of the year winner, because they didn't have the defensive player of the year award either in that period. You mentioned the blocks, like they didn't track blocks. So like it's either him or Wilt Chamberlain, all time leader in blocks in NBA history. So like as good as his resume looks right now, like it should be even more fantastic when you consider like what they weren't keeping track of, what they weren't handing out. But what is there is still, you know, pretty damn amazing. I guess just to start with one particular game that always comes to my mind is the game 7 from 1962, the NBA Finals, where, you know, he had the 30 points and 40 rebounds in an overtime victory over the LA Lakers. And, you know, that's just like the go-to game to point out where people are just like, well, you know, Russell wasn't that good at offense. It's like, okay, well, he wasn't scoring the ball like Will Chamberlain, but like he wasn't a zero on offense. Like he did have 30 points in a, you know, game 7, and the final score was 110-107. So it wasn't like a barn burner, like, you know, 160 to 150. Every point counted. And sorry for this little mini rant, but I can't remember the field goal percentage, but Russell in that particular game, he shot something like 55% from the field that game. So it wasn't like a, you know, a low effort percentage, like he's like, you know, kind of cleaned up because he just took a lot of shots. I do remember he was 14 for 17 from the free throw line in that game, which was highly unusual for Bill Russell because he shot 55% for his career from the free throw line. So that game for me, it's like the perfect Bill Russell game where it's like when the team needed him to score, he was out there scoring because everybody else was kind of cold from the field. Clearly, he was the one who's going to rebound. Those 40 rebounds are a record for the NBA playoffs. And career 55% free throw shooter, team needs every single point. He manages to make 85% of his free throws in that one particular game that they win by 3 points in overtime. So, like, if he had missed his average number of free throws, they would have lost that game in the series. So, for me, that's the quintessential Bill Russell game.
Yeah, it's great that you pointed that out, too, because that you know, that Bob Ryan interview I listened to a little bit earlier, he said that one of the things that Russell kind of annoyed him was, you know, people would say, you know, he's such a great defensive player. And he would stop him and say, you know, I was a really good offensive player, too. I didn't need to. Why am I going to take a bunch of shots when I have all these other guys that are better shooters than me? Why am I going to take a bunch of other shots when all these other guys, I can get them all opportunities? And he kind of would push back against that and say, hey, look, when I needed to get a point, I got a point. When I needed to score, I could score. And I'm glad that you brought that game up. That is one for sure. And I know, Jason, you have some numbers about some other playoff scoring outputs that he had too. It's like when that dude needed to, when he needed to put up 30 points, he put up 30 points. You know, when he needed to score, he could absolutely score. And in that case, like you said, it's great too, Curtis, that when he had to make free throws, it wasn't his strong suit, but he had, you know, in that game, he knew he had to do it. He had to do it. And it, whatever it took to win, no matter what that was, he was going to do it. And yeah, that's arguably one of my favorite Bill Russell games too, just because it proves to people that no, this dude, if he needed to, he could score. He didn't need to all the time.
Right. Yeah, he had 7 30-30 games in his career. Four of them actually happened in the playoffs, and three of them were in that 1962 playoffs. Two of them happened against Wilt Chamberlain in the 62 Eastern Division Finals. So he was on a hell of a run there. That was the Warriors, not the Sixers. I believe I said the Sixers. But yeah, 62 Warriors. They needed 7 games to beat them, and then they needed 7 games to beat the Lakers that year. So that was probably their toughest playoff run, at least until, you know, the very end. The other playoff 30-30, by the way, was 30 points and 38 rebounds. It was a deciding game of the 61 finals against the Hawks, which basically ended the Hawks' run as the Celtics' main challengers in the first 5 years of their dynasty. So yeah, he was absolutely, you know, killer, as we said. We'll have some other, you know, really strong box score, you know, some of his top games as well. But obviously, yeah, the 30 points, 40 rebounds, you know, in the 62 finals, you know, on a high percentage, probably, you know, his masterpiece.
Yeah. Okay. Here, just I brought up the box score, so, you know, we got to be correct here.
Yeah.
So I've slightly mixed up the field goal percentage. In that game 7 against the Lakers, he shot 44%. So my bad.
Right. Yeah.
The free throw was correct.
Yeah.
It was the previous game, game 6, which was still a must win because the Celtics were down 3-2 in that series. That's the game where he shot 55% from the field. But he had 19 points, 24 rebounds, and 10 assists. So like, it's like, all right, Bill, you only scored 19 points, but you dished out 10 assists. So hey, thanks for saving our butts. You know, must win game 6, then got back home to Boston, then got the must win game 7, obviously.
Yeah, that's just Amazing. And, the fact that Russell, was 10-0 in game sevens in his career. He played, this fact was bouncing around a bunch from on Twitter, but he played 21 winner take all games in his career between the NBA, the Olympics, and the NCAA tournament. His teams went 21-0 in those. And then in those games, in those 10 game sevens, he played 488 out of 495 possible minutes and averaged 29.3 rebounds. So just amazing. And he never, I don't think he ever had fewer than 21 rebounds in those 10 game sevens and performed really well in the vast majority of them. So, some of the greats, some of my favorite stories about Russell, there's, Russell was not particularly into practice, especially later on in his career. So eventually he would start just ruining practice by blocking every shot that came near him. Sometimes Auerbach would just tell Russell to go home early. The days he just called off practice completely because there wasn't really much point there wasn't much point. He was there. And then later on, in his career, basically Auerbach was like, there's rules for different rules for Russell. There's different rules for everybody else. And he would just sit out practice and, sit in the bleachers and be reading his paper and drinking his coffee. So I enjoy those. Whenever I feel like I want to slack off, I always just think about right. Russell. He's getting practice and he would have fun.
Yeah, so, and you're out of equal, success and accolades as well.
Absolutely. Right.
Feel free. Yeah, to sit and drink your coffee and read your paper. Your daily, your afternoon daily, whatever you're reading here. There's a lot of different stories and games and my probably favorite Bill Russell game ever is that 69 game seven. It's the balloon game. And I don't know. Do we know what the exact quote is? Because I know that half the people say that, those fucking balloons are staying up there. Some other people I see say, I want to watch them take the balloons out of the net by hand. I don't know. Curtis, do you know that if any of those were actually his quotes or those just kind of end up being, legend? They're great quotes no matter what. I mean, who cares? Yeah, I'm sure he said something similar, but.
I've actually heard audio of him saying to pick the balloons down one by one. I've heard audio of that, but I've never heard, not heard the audio of the, the effing balloons are staying up there. So
I could see him saying that to old Sam Jones.
In the locker room or whatever on the court. But I have heard audio.
Okay. All right.
I'm pretty sure it was him. I've heard that quote in audio form. I can't remember if it was him specifically or if someone saying Bill said that, but I've heard someone actually say those words.
Okay.
But whatever.
Yeah. I mean, that's just an all time. I mean, just showing up to the game. I believe it was Sam Jones finding out that there was a whole plan for, all right, so Jack Kent Cook is going to interview this guy at this time, and then the band's going to play this song, and those guys being like, no, we're not doing that. And Russell, he's the player coach at this time, and it's not his greatest game, obviously. It's 6 points. I still had 21 rebounds, a cool 21 rebounds, not bad. 2 of 7 from the field, but again, it speaks to just him, galvanizing that locker room. You will not hear from another guy. Everybody on that team will say that it was – Bill Russell, they got in that room and he was like, we're not losing this game. We're not losing this game. And Havlicek has an incredible game there. He has 26 points or whatever. After the game, Russell will thank Havlicek. He'll thank all these guys and say, these guys, bailed me out. These guys got me here. It's all about these teams. I didn't do anything. And it's like, well, you're the player coach. So yes, you did something. you're not, sure. Maybe you didn't score a ton of points. Maybe you didn't score 25 points, but you are the player coach and you presided over that win, which is, and it's not the most talented Celtics team. I mean, it's Havlicek, still pretty early in his career, but he's starting to, emerge as being, a guy that's like, oh, wow, this guy's going to take over when all those other guys go. But otherwise, it's, Russell in his final, season. He's still playing pretty good. He's still Bill Russell, but he's not, what he was before. Sam Jones is starting to slow down a little bit. And then on the other side, it's Jerry West, Elgin Baylor, Wilt Chamberlain. It's like, that team rocks. And then, the bench depth on LA is a little bit better than it is on Boston, and it doesn't matter. It just does not matter. Nothing matters because they have Bill Russell, and he just does not let that team lose.
Yeah, that was also Sam Jones's final game too.
Oh, right. So Right.
So
it's that was an old team. Yeah.
Yeah, and Sam, of course, has passed away 7 months ago. So,
right.
Sam had shoots. How about this? Sam Jones is 35 years old or 36, and he was 10 for 16 for 24 points in his last game.
Not bad. That's a good way to go. Yeah, geez.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a great story that I hadn't heard from. It's from The Athletic, and Bill Walton's actually telling the story, and he says, Jack Twyman's in the locker room before the seventh game. He looks at Bill Russell and says, with the camera rolling, he puts the microphone in his face and says, okay, Russ, what's going to happen? And Russell looks at him, looks at the camera, and says, we're going to win. And Twyman is taken aback. You know, Twyman's a Hall of Famer. As a television analyst, he's taken aback. He looks at Russell, and he says, well, how do you know? Russell looks at him, looks at the camera, just sneers right at the camera. We've done this before.
So yeah, just cool.
That's like some Clubber Lang kind.
Yeah, he's right the coolest fucker in the world, man. Jesus.
Yeah. Imagine having that confidence. I mean,
I'd love to have that for a minute of my life. Not today, maybe tomorrow, but probably not. So.
Well, I don't know if this is the right time to bring it up, but this came to my mind as we were talking about this. Honestly, you know, as a historian, like to, you know, remember that, you know, people aren't perfect. So, like, Bill Russell himself had to acknowledge that, like, he had to, you know, grow into the role as a coach. So, like, that first year he was a player coach, he admitted later on to, like, yeah, I kind of didn't know what I was doing exactly. He had a really hard time managing his own minutes while also paying attention to other people's minutes and just, yeah, you know, doing the two different roles at the same time. And so that, you know, also that happened to transpire at the exact same moment the 76ers had their greatest team ever, the 1967 season. So, you know, it's hard to tell, like, if Russ had been, you know, completely on this game as a coach and player, whether they could have beat the Sixers that year. But Russ said, like, nah, they had the better team than us, so we deserve to lose that year. But he said that, like, the next season, the 68 season, so his second one as player coach, he said that he was much better attuned to, you know, being a coach, but also being aware of what he was capable of doing, what the other guys on the court were capable of doing, monitoring people's minutes, kind of delegating a little authority to other people on the team. So I know Havlicek, and I forget who else, but he kind of designated other people as kind of like the co-coaches to be like, hey, make sure that you monitor and make sure I'm not, like, overplaying some people on the court. It's like I can't pay attention to everything that's happening during the game, so make sure you guys are also keeping an eye out. So he kind of learned to kind of loosen the reins a little bit the next year as a coach. So even Bill Russell has growing pains, even in, like, his 11th or 12th year in the NBA.
Yeah, and he definitely, I mean, he had mixed track record as a coach overall. I mean, you know.
Oh,
he,
yeah.
Putting it lightly.
Right. I mean, you know, he coached the Sonics, of course, in the 70s, and they were certainly better than they had been.
All right.
But they definitely, wore him out by the end. You know, there's a great story and from the book What's Happening, which is, you know, basically a book of the 77 Sonics, kind of the 78 landscape of the league. And I wish I remembered the specifics, and I forgot to look it up before here, but basically, you know, he's been, you know, the team has hated him, and he's hated the team for basically the entire season. He's ready to go. You know, they're not happy with him, so on and so forth. He's been kind of feeding with them the entire time. He knows he's about to leave, and there's a practice where, you know, and he's about 40 at this point, so he's, you know, obviously older, but still, you know, he's athletic at that point. And he just goes out of his way basically to, you know, punk, you know, some of the Sonics in practice. Like, you know, he won't let them, like, he keeps, like, continuously blocking their shot. It basically is just, like, a way of enforcing. It's like, yeah, I still got it. I'm still the man. You know, I'm still better than you'll ever be, kind of thing. You know, it was petty, but it's all awesomely petty. So, yeah, that's a fun one. You know, one thing that I really like is some of the stories about, you know, him trash talking, you know, some of the younger guys, or just his relationship with some of the younger players, even the great players. There's, you know, there's a story about, you know, Russell playing golf with Michael Jordan. And then, you know, they're basically, you know, it's right. They haven't won all the titles yet, but they've won some of their titles. And Jordan says, yeah, you know, we're going to go after your record. And then Russell's like, yeah, which one? You know, so, you know, I like the fact that he's, you know, talking trash about Michael Jordan, you know, talking trash to Michael Jordan back and forth. And they're, you know, talking about, like, you know, Jordan's like, oh, yeah, you guys only had like eight teams or whatever. And then, yeah, I was like, yeah, well, we didn't have to, you know, we weren't diluted by expansion either. He didn't say it that way. But basically, you know, it's like, yeah, in one hand, yeah, we had fewer teams. On the other hand, you know, I always had to fight, you know, basically the best guy or one of the top guys in the league just because, you know, things weren't thinned out by having a larger thing. So obviously, go ahead.
And he's totally right about that, too. It's something that, you know, I wish more people would push back against when they say, like, oh, there was only 8 teams in the league and all that sort of stuff. And I heard Kareem was on SiriusXM earlier today, and he was just like, yeah, I mean, put today's NBA and condense it to 8 teams. Like, that's a grueling, right. That's hard as hell. Like, that's not easier. That's not, you know, every team, there's just dogs on every team, you know, 5-10 deep on every single team. I mean, it's just easy to say, oh, well, yeah, it was only, you know, of course their chances, it was a lot easier to win a title. Because no, it was not that easy, because you were playing the best players every single night, no matter what. And you know, the you know, playing Wilt Chamberlain, I think it was 142 times or something like that, or 143 times in the regular season. I mean, you didn't get a break. You didn't get a break any night against any of these teams. And that's, you know, something I wish more people would push back on when, you know, you get these just very, you know, basic, generic, you know, oh, well, it was easier to win in the next 60s because there was only this amount of teams or whatever. It's like, well, yeah, there was fewer teams, but there were, you know, a lot of good players and they were on fewer teams. You know, that's it. It's
right.
That doesn't make it all the way easier. It makes every game a lot harder. So, yeah, I wish more people would bring that up.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And speaking of Kareem, you know, he told a story on his Substack. He said he was 67 years old when he finally got the courage to ask Bill for something he'd wanted since meeting him 53 years ago. He told a story about meeting Kareem meeting Russell at 14 years old when he was in high school. And he actually asked Russell for an autograph. And, you know, Russell was notorious for, right, I guess notorious is the right word, but was well known for not giving autographs. He said he'd rather, you know, shake somebody's hand or tell a story. He didn't really want to, you know, do that. He wouldn't even give autographs to his teammates for a very long time. Later on, he kind of relaxed that. He actually made quite a bit of money on the autograph market by, you know, signing it for collectors. So it was a way for him to make income later in his life. But he pulled out his jersey for the Celtics. He held a black Sharpie and then he gave me a long look. He took the jersey and Sharpie, he signed to hand it back. And then he said, Kareem said, thanks. And then Russell said, sure, kid. And he said, he continued to call me kid since our first meeting when I was 14. I think that was his good natured way of reminding me that he was there first and I would always be following in his giant step. So that was that was really cool. There's also another story about, you know, a few years into Kareem's career, obviously they never faced each other. You know, they were right on the edge of each other. And a writer asked Russell how he would have done against Kareem. And then Russell replied, young man, you have the question backwards. So I like that story.
Yeah, that sounds like Russell.
The
quiet trash talker.
Yes. Yeah.
Would never directly insult somebody else, but he would just, yeah, have these little bars to make sure that you kind of get the respect in order.
Yeah. So, I like some things about, you know, Russell's psychology. There's a SI article from Frank DeFord, which was written in 1999, you know, when Sports Illustrated was celebrating its 60th anniversary, talking about the top athletes. And, you know, he told a few stories about, you know, how Russell would, like, kind of take it easy in training camp. And, you know, kind of some of the rookies, some of the young players would think, like, oh, yeah, maybe he's lost it. Maybe he's, you know, got it. But then in the first game of the real season, he would suddenly, you know, he would play like he used to play and he would, you know, be intimidated. And the Celtics were known for getting out to fast starts and trying to get a large lead, you know, for the first, you know, 30 games of the season there, and then kind of taking a little bit easier after that once it was clear that they were going to win the division again. So I thought that was a fun one. Even Russell said himself that, like, he'd like to, as he came out for a game, I'm going to try to get this, this quote here that he, I'm losing it right now, but basically, he would say that that he would he kind of like would try to like come out like looking like he was like a little bit sleepy, looking like he was not quite you know all the way there. Yeah, he would. He said, "I'd look at everybody disdainfully like a sleepy dragon who can't be bothered to scare off another would-be hero." He recalled, "I wanted my look to say, hey, the king's here tonight."
Damn. Yeah. There you go. That's, yeah. That's pretty awesome. You know, one thing, and we've talked a lot about, you know, the good in Russell's career and the accomplishments and that sort of stuff. And, you know, we touched on it a little bit, but I think, you know, now might be a pretty good time to dive into it. The Tommy Heinsohn quote that I'll bring up, and we'll talk about his, you know, his complicated history with the city of Boston and help sure. with America, really. It says, "Look, all I know The guy won two NCAA championships, 50-some college games in a row, the 1956 Olympics. Then he came to Boston. He won 11 championships in 13 years, and they named a fucking tunnel after Ted Williams.
Yeah.
Sounds about right for Tom Heinsohn. Let me try to find this quote I have from Tommy Heinsohn. But go ahead, Jason. It's going to take me a minute to find this quote from Tommy.
Sure. Yeah, I this is also a good way to kind of get into some of the more details about Russell. As a strong, outspoken black man, as a an advocate of civil rights, of social justice, of black empowerment, that was
freedom. Right. Can I have freedom, please? I am a citizen of this country. Do you mind if I have freedom?
Sure. And that obviously rankled a lot of white people and a lot of white people in Boston during that time. I mean, obviously, the atmosphere in Boston is known as being, extremely, virulent. Russell had to deal and his family had to deal with, racial slurs, of course, across the country, but especially, a lot in Boston. Obviously, you would see that mostly by living there. There's stories of like vandalism in his home, of like people like defecating in his bed sheets, just horrible things for for just reasons is that he wasn't just willing to be quiet about the things that he believed in, the things that he advocated for. I mean, he was obviously on the forefront of the civil rights movement. He went to Mississippi to help with the civil rights struggle there, and help had some basketball camps down there to bring some good cheer to the people who were down there and help supporting them. So it did all kinds of things for social justice in his career. Obviously, most of those things are now seen by most people as heroic, but at the time they were obviously very controversial with the vast majority of white people at the time.
Yeah, and that's actually at the very beginning of the pod when you asked me, whatever your question was, your grand question about Bill Russell. my first thought was actually like, Bill Russell was really cool because he helped me write my dissertation real easily. As easy as you can write a dissertation. Like his two memoirs, his old memoirs, Go Up for Glory and Second Wind are, just such good. Especially Go Up for Glory was so good at just capturing the NBA because that came out in 1966. So like that's just great at capturing the moment right then and there of how the league was operating. But in reading his memoirs, obviously newspapers and other people's memoirs like Lenny Wilkins and others, like just people like Bill Russell just helped, and Elgin Baylor too, helped kind of give a kick in the ass to NBA players, particularly the white ones, because this is something I kind of came to a conclusion through my research, was just like, as Rich said too, like Bill Russell's like fighting for freedom. So in his workplace, that meant like, getting some benefits for playing in this basketball league. Right. But like Bob Cousy had founded the players union like in 54, if I remember right. But Cousy was kind of like, he knew it was right. But Cousy, like, as he said many times over the years, is just kind of like, averse of conflict. So, like, he was like, we need these things, but I'm not trying to push the envelope too far. But when you get these black players like Bill Russell and Elgin Baylor who are like, no one do we want a pension. We also want this racism crap to stop. So, like, they came in, like, with a much more, like, black power is not a thing in the late 1950s, but they came in with just a more militant attitude on a number of things. And so, like on the one hand, let me put it this way. On the one hand, Bill Russell wasn't Bob Cousy in the way that like he wasn't averse to conflict on the labor front. But then also Bill Russell wasn't, say, Earl Lloyd or Chuck Cooper, like the first wave of black players in the NBA, because Earl Lloyd and Chuck Cooper, they kind of were just trying to make sure that black players had any place in the NBA. So they were kind of afraid that if they rocked the boat too much, integration is going to stop completely. They're going to kick out all the black players, and then you won't have anything going forward for them. Well, when you get Bill Russell and Elgin Baylor in the league, like they pretty much established, you can't operate this league without us, these black superstars. Like as good as Earl Lloyd was still just a role player, a very good role player, but still a role player. Like Bill Russell and Elgin Baylor, they're anchoring these franchises. So they have the power now to demand that the NBA no longer acquiesce to these racist Jim Crow accommodations or these games. So And that gives a backbone to a lot of the white players too. And they realize like, oh wait, the black guys stood up to the owners on racism and the owners kind of caved, like not all at once, not all immediately, but slowly they cave over time to what they demanded. And so the white players begin to realize like, well, shit, you know, we can, you know, join up with our black brothers here, like to push for our labor rights. And, that brings it back to Tommy Heinsohn. Like, you know, he's upset about Boston not naming that bridge, that tunnel after Bill Russell. Well, Heinsohn, he had a quote in his memoir where he wrote that, I found the quote finally, where he said, like, you know, he and Bill Russell were talking. I think it was their rookie year because they were both rookies the same season. And Heinsohn wrote that he talks about how Russell said on the West Coast, they once picked Kenny Sears, great player, but white. They picked Kenny Sears of Santa Clara as player of the year over Bill Russell. And Russell told Tom Heinsohn that this was just because Sears was white. Russell wasn't saying Sears wasn't a good player, but Russell was also like, I'm better than Sears, though. Like, I led San Francisco to two straight NCAA titles. No way is Kenny Sears a better player than I am. And Heinsohn was just like, nah, that can't be true. This is what he's thinking as a rookie. But then he's like, admits when he wrote the book, he's like, well, he's like, nah, at that point in time, I wouldn't accept that such a racial explanation could be the explanation. But then he writes, through my years with the Celtics, after Russell joined the team, I learned that there were such things, that, you know, white people would be so racist as to give an award to an undeserving player over a more deserving player simply because of their race. So Bill Russell gave backbone and also opened the eyes to a lot of white players in the NBA to realize that, like, yeah, there's a lot of racism going on, but also that you can also stand up on the labor front, too, for what you want and demand. And, like, Bill Russell showed them that it was possible to do this. So for me, that's what makes Bill Russell so important, is that, like, yeah, his fight for freedom was a racial fight, but it was also a fight on labor rights. It was also a fight for social justice, economic justice, democratic justice. I was just rereading part of his memoir earlier today, and he was just talking about all these different things in 1979. I'm like, wow, this is all pretty relevant for today. And as Rich said earlier, like, he was still, you know, protesting in his old way. He's pretty old, of course, but was still protesting in his own way on Twitter, commenting on what he saw was going wrong in American society. So, sorry for that kind of little bit of a rambling answer, you know, kind of weaving in and out there. But that's what makes Bill Russell so great, and how he affected the racial climate of the NBA back in the 50s and 60s, but even America, really till the day he died. So,
yeah. No, and that's great. And yeah, and I think he, you know, in the later years, I think he added, I think the fact that he's weighing in on the more modern social protests, like, gives them some additional weight, maybe with people that it wouldn't have if it weren't for Russell, just because of the respect that he had. You know, I mean, there's other guys doing it too. I'm not saying it made, you know, like, a complete difference, but I think, you know, the picture of him kneeling, you know, and with the Presidential Medal of Freedom around his neck, you know, I do think that those things, you know, were a great way for him to weigh in, and were, you know, I think were somewhat beneficial for the cause. But yeah, you talk about, you know, what he did, obviously, for labor rights. You know, there's the 1961 game in Lexington, Kentucky, where, yep, you know, he and other players are refused service at a restaurant before the game. So, you know, he and those players end up, you know, boycotting the game and leaving it. You know, there's a famous story with Frank Ramsey, who he was close with. You know, Ramsey is, you know, asking, you know, Russell, like, hey, I know this is horrible, but, you know, it would really mean a lot to me if you played this game. And Russell is just like, hey, I'm a man, you know, I'm not, I can't do this. I can't, you know, accept this kind of treatment. I can't play this game, you know, after this has happened. And, you know, eventually Ramsey, understanding that, but that was definitely a controversial stand, you know, during that time. You know, Elgin Baylor had a similar one in West Virginia around the same time. So, you know, as you mentioned, Baylor, Oscar Robertson, you know, all those guys really, really, you know, again, because they're so great at the game, because they're so important to their teams, they're able to, you know, push boundaries and are able to, you know, eventually gain larger black representation for the league. You're able to, you know, to battle past, you know, the unofficial quota system, and able to transform the game into, you know, majority black game. And it's such an important game for black culture.
Yeah, and speaking of what Curtis talked about earlier, you know, setting the template too for then labor issues in the NBA later, of saying, hey, look, right, you can just boycott a game, you just not show up, And these guys can't do anything. You know what I mean? If we're not here, if we're not playing, there's no game. So you know what? If there's something you want, if there's something you really, really think is important, you don't have to play. You just don't show up, and they will either say, all right, game's canceled, everybody, here's your money back, or they will meet your demands. And you know, we saw that later, a couple years later with the All-Star game after that. So that, you know, like Curtis said, it was a way not only to, you know, speak up for what was going on with his race, but then also kind of set the template for just labor issues in general for the NBA, which is not equally important, but very important for a number of people as well.
I mean, they went hand in hand for like Bill Russell and because like, you know, as he's thinking about it, you know, like just think, for example, with the 1963 March on Washington, which Russell actually had critiques of. He was like, this is a little too much kumbaya going on here. Russell's like, this is getting a little diluted. Like he still approved of the march, but he's like, it's not as militant as I would like it to be. But like, the people don't often know that the full name of the March on Washington is the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. And so, like, the civil rights movement wasn't just about like, oh, let's make sure that we can sit at a lunch counter and order whatever, you know, sandwich we want. They also wanted to make sure they could get whatever job they were qualified to get, or that they could get the training to be qualified for whatever job they wanted. So, you know, for Bill Russell, like, yes, you know, the NBA is a kind of peculiar workplace, but it's still a workplace. So for him, it's like, you know, if I'm a qualified basketball player, then I should be able to, you know, make the NBA and not be subjected to a quota system. Or if there's an award to hand out, I should get it over Kenny Sears if I'm better than Kenny Sears, which he was better than Kenny Sears. So in that regard, like, they're very much connected. And like, again, Russell knew that, like, you know, the NBA is a very peculiar place, but he knew that, like, you know, there are many kinds of NBAs out there across society where black people were getting a fair shake. But also in the bigger scheme of things, he knew that all kinds of people weren't getting a fair shake for all sorts of reasons. And this actually gets this is something I often talked about with high school students is also in 1963, you know, when Medgar Evers was assassinated in Mississippi, Bill Russell, you know, gave the basketball clinic in Mississippi shortly afterwards, the first integrated basketball clinic in that state's history. And he got death threats, you know, like the Klan was like, hey, you don't run a basketball clinic where blacks and whites are going to be playing together. And Russell still did it. But he said Russell wrote shortly afterwards, again, in his 66 book. It was a pretty sad commentary on the United States that he could represent the United States with the State Department and basketball clinics overseas in Africa, South America, Europe, even he went to communist countries during the Cold War and put on, like, you know, goodwill games. He's like, isn't it a shame and a kind of crazy that I can do all that, but I get death threats when I try to hold a basketball clinic in Mississippi in my own country? And he's born in Louisiana. So, like, you know, in the state next to the one I was born in, I can't hold a basketball clinic without getting death threats. So his critiques of the United States were very searing, but right on point. And it was definitely, I guess, from race initially, but it would expand to a lot of other things as time went on. So, but yeah, I highly encourage people to go read his two memoirs, Go Up for Glory and Second Wind. Like, those are just still fantastic books that hold up still today.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, they're both terrific insights into, obviously, into his life and his career in the NBA at the time. And, you know, both are really amazing. I'd like to get to a few more of the top games of his career. You know, we're I found at stathead.com. You know, one is against the Syracuse Nationals, February 5th, 1960, 23 points, 51 rebounds, the second most in a game in NBA history. 51 rebounds is just an incredible number to think about. Obviously, there are more missed shots than there were more. It was a faster pace then. So, you know, it's not a number that we'd ever come close to today, but that's just, you know, incredible to think about. He had more rebounds than all of his teammates combined. And he had 40 plus rebounds 11 times in his career. As we said, he was, you know, second most rebounds, points or rebounds per game of any player other than Will Chamberlain again. And as we talked about, yeah, just the way that he used rebounding as a weapon, you know, the driving the Celtics fast break, I mean, really transformed the style of the game in so many ways that he was an innovator on the court. We also have game five of the 1966 finals against the Lakers, 32 points, which was his playoff career high, 28 rebounds. He was 32 at this point. The series was tied 2-2. The Celtics ended up winning the series in seven games. He also had 28 and 26 in an earlier overtime loss in that series and 25 and 32 in game seven of that series, man. Poor Jerry West, you know, Elgin Baylor, man. They just they couldn't win, literally couldn't win against Bill Russell, you know. Couple other games where the Lakers were the victims. 25 points, 16 rebounds, 9 assists in game three of the 68 finals. That's one where Boston won in six. And then 23 points, 25 rebounds, and 10 assists in game two of the 1965 finals. I believe I thought I had written down the number of triple doubles that he had in his career. Here he had, I think, around 20 triple doubles in his career. And he again is in his game sevens. He had 10 of them. He was 10-0. Two of them were in overtime, and 8 of those game sevens were 5 points or less. That's incredible to think about how many of those games were absolutely close, and you know they. He happened to win them all. Obviously, there was some luck there, but you know, there's too many of those for that to be coincidence. But in those, never had fewer than 21 rebounds. He had 15 or more points in all but two of them. They only shot poorly from the field in two of them. I mean, I would say 8 of those games were absolutely, you know, terrific games on his part. So, yeah, just, you know, remarkable performer, you know, in in pretty much all aspects of the game, and you know, and just the NBA community obviously is going to, miss him tremendously.
So. Yeah. I remember a few years. Oh my God. I can't remember how many years ago now it was, but a long time ago, y'all just go on Google and try to find it. I wrote an article for Sporting News, about like the close calls of Bill Russell and like these kind of game sevens, might've been some game fives as well. So those were do or die games depending on the series. I kind of just did it as an exercise of like, okay, like, even if Bill Russell got a little lucky sometimes, which of course he did, like, you know, Frank Selby shot careening off the rim, like that's lucky. Russell was not near that shot. Frank Selby was open. If he makes that, the Celtics lose. But anyways, I was like, even saying like if Bill Russell loses some of these really close calls that are kind of a coin flip, he still easily comes out with 6 or 7 NBA championships. And it's just like, okay, so he was lucky to win 4 titles, but he absolutely did win 6 or 7 of them. So it's just like, that's how good he was at corralling the talent on the Celtics. It's just, so if people want to complain about like, you know, oh, it was only an 8-team league, it's like, well, you know, there's not really any other players. Like, you want to give everybody else the benefit of the doubt? Like,
maybe right, yeah. A lot of other people played when he played, and they don't have 11 rings. So
yeah, like if the breaks had gone the other way, like Bob Pettit has 2 NBA titles. Wilt Chamberlain might have 3 or 4. Baylor and West might have 3 or 4. Bill Russell still has 6 or 7. So right. He's still standing tall above the other players of his era, even if the breaks, we give it the benefit to the other guys who ended up on the wrong end of the stick in some of those games. So that really just speaks to the kind of the domination that him and the Celtics had back in that era.
Yeah, and it extends. Obviously, we don't know. I mean, his college career is legendary as well. It's not like this, you know. A lot of other people play college basketball at that same time as well.
Right.
Very few people dominated the way he dominated. So yeah, it's you know, is there some luck involved? Of course, there's always some luck involved. Is there big moments and big times where guys stepped up and in some cases bailed him out? Like I think there's the you know when Havlicek steals the ball, I think the famous quote afterwards is Bill Russell saying, "Well, thank you, you saved my ass because I screwed up and I could have ruined that game for us, but you bailed me out and you did that." Like, yeah, there's some luck involved. There's some other great, but yeah, it's still, this is one of the all time most dominant players in basketball history. You don't even have to qualify to NBA basketball history. I mean, just look at everything that he did over the course of his basketball career, and this is a guy that just dominated and just won more than anybody else. And yeah, all right, take a few away from him, like you said, Curtis. All right, he still has 8. All right, cool.
Right.
Like, you know, yeah. Like, all right, he's only got 8 titles. There,
all right.
One.
Yeah. All right,
right. Yeah. Oh, what a loser. Yeah, yeah. You know,
exactly.
Yeah. And just a couple things on his offense that hasn't been mentioned yet: the assist numbers. For a center. Until Nikola Jokic came along recently, he's kind of, just skewed the numbers entirely these last couple of years. But it was basically Bill Russell and Will Chamberlain as the best passing, or at least you can say best assisting, big man in NBA history. Like, Russell averaged about 4.5 assists per game. And, like, honestly, those of y'all listening, go look up how many centers have averaged three and a half assists for their entire career. It is not a whole lot.
Yeah.
So, like, Russell and Chamberlain were at the top of that. They didn't give out assists easily back in the day. Like, this is something that people need to understand. Like, rebounds were plentiful back then, but assists were not plentiful back then. So if you got an assist, it was, like, directly leading to a shot, like, either straight away a shot or one dribble in a shot. None of this, oh, well, he kind of held it for 5 seconds and then took a dribble, and then you still get credit for an assist. So there's that front. But then there's also the dunking. This gets overlooked all the time. Like, Bill Russell was the first NBA player to dunk with regularity. Like, that gets shortchanged. Like, just, yes, players were capable of doing it beforehand, but most of them didn't have the audacity to do it. You know, most notably Jim Pollard with the Lakers, the Minneapolis Lakers. But Russell was 6'10". It was just like, I'm really tall, and I can just, like, you know, just jump over people and dunk the ball. Why am I wasting my time trying to be fancy with it? So he made the NBA not just, you know, I guess, say vertical defensively by just blocking a lot of shots, but also made it more vertical with the dunk. And obviously Will Chamberlain came in a couple of years later and made it even more demonstrative. But Russell deserves credit on that front, too, for being the first player to use the dunk as a really an offensive weapon in NBA history.
Yeah, and doing it in traffic, too. You know, going back and watching a lot of his games and watching, you know, highlights and stuff. I mean, the velocity that he'll just get up and just stretch that arm out. Like we said, he's not the tallest guy. There are definitely guys that are taller, but very few.
But he's still 6'10".
Yeah, he's still a big boy.
He's taller than Alonzo Mourning and the same height as Hakeem Olajuwon.
Right. Yeah. And the velocity at which and the speed at which you can see him doing his dunks. I mean, that, especially when you consider, like, who the NBA centers were before that. And that's, I'm not disrespecting any of those guys, but then this guy coming, you see why he was such a dynamo, because it's like, holy crap, like, look at this guy. He's jumping, he's running, he's dunking, he's doing this sort of stuff. That's not taking away anything from those guys that came before him, but man, nobody was. I mean, look at the speed and the velocity that this guy's playing with. You can see why it was a shock to the system when he comes in the league, and he's just completely dominating things. And like you said, the passing too, that was something that I always, every time I'll go watch old Bill Russell things, you'll see him get the ball in the post, and it's almost like he's looking for the pass first. He could turn around, and he's Bill Russell. You know, if he wanted to, he could probably turn around and make a little, you know, baby hook or just a little, you know, whatever the hell shot. But he's looking, because one of the other Celtics is probably going to cut in the next few seconds. And you see it just every single time. He hesitates for a second, and if someone cuts and they have a good cut, he passes off to them. And a lot of times they'll miss the shots, because, you know, guys missed a lot of shots in those days too. Right. Like you said, those assist numbers would maybe look a little bit different in different leagues. But yeah, I mean, it's like you spoke to that, Curtis. Five centers in NBA history average over 4 assists per game. And like you said, Jokic is 6.2. He's a different animal altogether. Like, you know, we take him away, it's Maurice Stokes, Wilt Chamberlain, Bill Russell, Alvin Adams. That's the entire list of centers that averaged over 4 assists per game in NBA history. You know, Jokic at 6.2 completely changes the game, completely, you know, a different player. But yeah, it speaks, like, and like you said, they weren't really giving him out a whole lot either. So, you know, imagine in this environment, in this, you know, or hell, if he was playing in Utah during the days when John Stockton was playing, how many assists would this guy have? Who knows? Like, you know, Stockton was able, you know, hey, pump fake, dribble, pump fake, hey, whoa, hey, assists, you know, like, which I'm fine with. You know what? Hey, if you're a home scorer, you know, it's
whatever
it's,
works.
Yeah.
All right. Print legend. Yeah. All right. Any closing thoughts?
I don't know, man. How to summarize Bill Russell when he closing thoughts on him?
Wow. Yeah, I'm asking tough questions here. Yeah.
Yeah, I just don't think we're going to have another guy like him ever again. Like Curtis said at the top, like, there's only, I mean, Kareem is probably the last guy that we'll have that has that sort of, you know, impact on the game and on humans, you know, in a lot of ways. It's like, you know, and you know, not taking anything away from Kareem, but I do think Russell probably stands a little higher in that. Not, you know, again, and Kareem did a ton in his career. But yeah, it does feels like this is maybe one of the last few guys that we're going to have. And I spoke to a little bit earlier that, like, you know, you need guys like a Bill Russell to make people realize like what was going on in this country not that long ago. This isn't, you know, 200 years ago, not sure. that long ago, you know, a guy that was a contemporary part of our lives, that, you know, us talking here went through all of this stuff. Kareem will attest to that as well, but we're getting lower and lower on the list of guys that are going to do that. And that's going to be unfortunate because now it's going to make it seem like it's farther in the past. Oh, you know, oh, those, that's when photos were black and white and video was black and white. It wasn't that long ago that this stuff was happening. And like we said, too, a lot of the stuff is it's not like everything's sunshine and roses now. Like, oh, we solved all the problems. Everything is good to go. We're ready to go. But no, he is going to be one of the last few guys that is going to have that sort of impact that we're going to talk about. You know, when Michael Jordan passes away, everyone's going to talk about the accomplishments. Everybody's going to talk about the rings and the scoring and the dunks and that sort of stuff. You know, the guys that are going to get equal footing, like Curtis said at the top, where they're going to be on CNN and they're going to be talking about what they did culturally. You know, we're few and far between. There's not too many of those players left in the world, and that's in some ways kind of stinks because it's going to make it seem like it was a lot longer ago that this sort of stuff happened.
Sure.
You know, I guess I'll say Bill Russell had there's just a weight to everything that he did. So, I mean, clearly, you have some weight when you win 11 titles and five MVPs and my mythical imaginary nine finals MVP awards that he should have in the case as well.
Yeah.
But, you know, just to be someone, you know, who would hold a basketball clinic under threat of death, like,
and just not give a
shit. I don't
think
there's a lot of NBA players right now who'd be like, they're like, hey, man, like, this group is threatening to kill you if you hold this basketball clinic. I think the player would be like, well, we're going to cancel the clinic. Wait, understandably. Like, we'll cancel the clinic until things kind of cool off. But right. Bill Russell was like, that's the way America is right now. So that's what I got to do. So, I guess take this next part as even-handedly as I'm trying to make it. But, I do think that we sometimes overvalorize people in the civil rights movement from the 50s and 60s, just in terms of we kind of make them more heroic. Because, like, you know, that's just the way the country was at that point. And so for them to be treated like humans, they had to do this stuff. So the situation demanded that they be heroic. And so, like, obviously not everybody still at that moment. Some people were fine just to, like, slink away. But Russell should be lauded for standing up like that. But I would also like to think, though, that there are some NBA players today who, if they were transported, you know, back to 1957 or 1965, still would have had to, you know, the wherewithal to still stand up in that kind of moment and be like, I'm not going to be treated like this anymore. So Bill Russell is definitely a unique and important human being, but also his circumstances also kind of elicited this kind of heroic stand from him at many moments. So I don't want to, you know, like, crap on the current players, be like, oh, these guys would never do that. I'm like, yeah, it's like, I think a lot of them, if they were put in that same situation, would have responded in the same way as Russell. But it's just that, well, you know, we're glad that we did have people like Russell at that moment in 1960, and Oscar Robertson and Elgin Baylor and even Tom Heinsohn, you know, the white guy who's like, yeah, this isn't right. They're treating the black guys like this. And like, at least, you know, he wasn't on the line like Russell was, but at least Heinsohn wasn't trying to hold Russell back. So, give him 5% credit too, but, like, you know, give Russell 95% of the credit. But, but yeah, like, you know, thanks to those guys doing what they did, like, we don't want, LeBron James doesn't have to have a death threat against him for trying to hold a basketball clinic, in Akron, Ohio. So, so that aside there, the weight with Russell is on that front, but it's also just in the way he comported himself, even it kind of just mundane matters. It's like, if he was just doing an interview, just the way he spoke and carried himself, just let you know that whatever he was saying, you kind of had to just listen to it. Mm-hmm. Like, there was some wisdom coming across, like, whether he was talking about the heavy stuff like politics or injustice, clearly you listen to him. But even if he's just talking about, how do you treat teammates? How do you play basketball? Like, just the way he spoke about that was also, weighty. Yeah, and just how he talked about people, his opponents, like, you know, his interviews about Wilt Chamberlain over the years. You know, they had a little tit for tat, you know, back in the late 60s and early 70s. They had a bit of a falling out, like, so, you know, they're still human. But he would always still, you know, give his compliments to Wilt Chamberlain and his other opponents, being like, you know, I played against some great players. Like, he was never one to, like, you know, discredit his opponents. But there's always weight to what he says. So when he complimented an opponent, you know that he did mean that that opponent was really good. And when he thought a team was better than him, when the Celtics lost, he didn't try to make excuses like, oh, yeah, you know, we had bad luck there. He's like, no, the other team was better. They beat us.
Yeah.
So he would not try to detract from what other people did. So, yeah, just an honest dude who gave a lot of weight to everything he did. And, yeah, it's going to be – as I say, it's going to be very doubtful that we ever see anybody like him again in the NBA.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and there's, you know, and, you know, I saw the footage earlier of, you know, Muhammad Ali, you know, sitting at the table and the dignitaries that were around him. And, you know, again, it made you, like I said, like there's not many more guys that are like that. There's not many more guys that lived through that, that we're going to have those iconic images of. You know, seeing them sit at that table and do what they do and fight for what they're fighting for and speak for what they're speaking for. It's and that kind of sucks. It's just that we're you know, it's good in the sense that, you know, progress has been made in some ways, but also it just sucks because, you know, the like I said, it's just going to feel like it was so much longer ago because all those guys, we're going to look at that image and say, oh, well, all those guys are dead and they've been dead for a while. And it's, you know, we'll make it easier to think that it was farther in the past or make it think that we've kind of moved forward and that sort of stuff. But yeah, always, you know, that table, I think Kareem's at that table too, right?
Yep.
Yeah. So it's like shit, you know. Right. You know, so at least we still have Kareem. But yeah, it's, and we're going to, unfortunately, you know, from the NBA side, they've always had that thing we've always talked about on this show that, like, remarkable that, like, most NBA MVPs are not dead. You know what I mean? Like, a lot – for a while, it was just Wilt. And then it was Kobe. And Kobe was, you know, under tragic circumstances. It's going to unfortunately start happening a lot more pretty soon because these guys are starting to get to that age. So that's also the thing, too. It's like, you know, NBA has enjoyed a lot of the older players being there, being visible, being up front, being, you know – we can see them at All-Star Weekend. We could see them during the championship, and little by little, those guys are going to start to kind of fade away. And we've seen a lot over the last few years, and it's definitely going to get real sad real quick. So
yeah, you know, I think of just the influence that Russell has on the modern game about, you know, how we've talked about it already, how he and Baylor, Oscar Robertson, Wilt, you know, were able to help, you know, grow the game to a point where it had the foundation that, you know, that it took off. Of course, you know, the Bird Magic and Jordan era, the 80s and 90s, and how, you know, the brave stands that, you know, Russell, you know, was, and others, his contemporaries, were forced to take because of circumstances have, you know, made what, you know, like somebody like LeBron is doing, or Carmelo Anthony, or Chris Paul, those guys who are, you know, they're advocating for social justice, but they're doing it, and it's a much more acceptable thing, I think, a large, you know, across the country than it was 50 years ago. Obviously, you know, it's a different thing, so it doesn't seem as brave, but in a sense, you know, Russell paved the way for those things to be acceptable, and obviously, you know, his just setting a standard that yet no one can ever live up to, basically, in terms of, you know, his championships and team and just how, but that's, you know, something that everybody shoots for. You see all those, you know, there's a great clip of Magic and Bird and Russell just kind of talking. It's like, you know, Magic's like, yeah, we're all shooting for this guy. You know, I got five, but, you know, he set the standard so high, there's no way I could get there. There's no way that any of us could get there. So I think that's, you know, on the court and off the court, like you guys said, there's never going to be anybody like him again. So we're thankful that, you know, he gave what he gave in his life. And, you know, this is it's just such a tremendous thing. And, you know, if you're, you know, interested in learning more about Bill Russell, you know, we did a 13-part series on his career, WrestleMania, like 6 years ago, which is hard to believe it's been that long. And Curtis was on some of those episodes. We'll share some links to those as well for anyone who wants to get more into, you know, his specifics of his rivalries with Wilt, or, you know, any of the other teams that he played against. But lots of great stuff here. But this has been, you know, a tremendous, really enjoyable to be on the show. Curtis, you know, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Oh, pleasure as always. Love to talk hoops with you guys. You're so knowledgeable. You know your stuff. So great conversation as usual.
Thanks, everyone, of course, for checking us out. And we appreciate it. And thanks for listening. And we'll be back again soon.